through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Mahler. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Hello, this is Claudia Shambaugh, your host of Ask a Leader, airing on Tuesday mornings from 9 until 10. Join me as we explore the worlds of leaders of all stripes, of all ages, from all realms of our society. These leaders may be voted into office, appointed, anointed, or volunteers. We'll examine them all in this show. Subjects include politics, government, religion, human rights, culture, physical and mental health, and more. We'll find leaders in places the rest of us aren't even looking.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI, Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Good morning and welcome to this January 4th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined now by Thridi Umregard, and coming up in the second half hour, Vicki Goldberg will be here discussing her photographic work, The White House, The President's Home in Photographs and History. Thridi Umregard is the author of four previous novels, The Weight of Heaven, The Space Between Us, If Today Be Sweet, and Bombay Time, and the memoir First Darling of the Morning. A journalist for nearly 20 years, she is the winner of the Nieman Fellowship for Harvard, winner of the 2009 Cleveland Arts Prize, and a 2006 finalist for the Penn Beyond Margins Award. She is a professor of English at Case Western Reserve University, lives in Cleveland. The book we will be talking about this morning is The World We Found. It went on sale yesterday. It's fantastic, and it's my huge pleasure to welcome her. Thridi, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I've been a fan since Bombay Time. I'm a huge lover of Indian literature, so this is a treat for me.
Thank you.
So tell me, let's start out. I'll give you a chance to talk about the novel a little bit, where The World We Found came from, and your inspiration for writing it.
Yeah, you know, the novel sort of originated, the genesis for the novel came in 2008. It was a chance meeting with an old friend, an old college friend of mine, who I had not seen in about 25 years and had completely lost touch with. And I was visiting a family in India, and we happened to run into each other and spent an afternoon together. And in the course of that afternoon, we were sort of talking about the different directions that our lives have taken us since those heady college days. And she was a political activist when I knew her last, and she had pretty much turned away from that life over the years. And when I asked her why, she traced it back to the Hindu-Muslim riots that occurred in India in 1992-93. And she basically said that she shied away from politics after that. It was such a disillusioning experience for her. And even though I disagreed with the conclusions that she drew from that, I could certainly at a very subjective and visceral level relate to the utter sense of disillusionment that I myself experienced when I read about those riots. I had left India, you know, at least 10 years prior to them and was living in America at the time, but really had this very sad sense of that the city that I knew and loved and had grown up with had just changed permanently, had been scarred permanently as a result of those riots. And somewhere in all that, the idea for this novel came about.
Was she some sort of inspiration of character, or did you take the germ of the idea and then build characters separate and apart from her?
Yeah, you know, I can't say that any of the four women who make up this novel, I can't really trace them to any of the people that I knew growing up in that same time period. In fact, I've sort of said this before that, you know, generally when readers ask me whether something is autobiographical or if it's related or based on people that I know, most of the time the answer is no. But in this particular case, I can really see a little bit of myself in each one of these four characters. So it's really me talking about my experiences as a young student activist in the 1970s and, you know, sort of then spinning a world of fiction after that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about this this process of mining character. Obviously, you know, all of your novels are fairly character-driven, and your process of sort of getting into the minds of the characters, whether these people find you, if they come to you a little bit fully formed, if it's a process of sort of excavating them over the course of the novel and finding out things about them that, you know, as you put them in different situations, right, certain things that they do. Tell me a little bit about learning about these people and your process for fleshing them out.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I suppose the accurate answer is it's a little of both. I mean, on one hand, before I embark on a project, I have a fairly good sense of where the novel is headed, what direction it's headed in. And, you know, by definition, then, if you have a sort of sense of where the novel is going to take you, by definition, then you basically know a little bit about your characters, too.
Yeah.
But I've always said that the most pleasant surprises in the act of writing occur in the process of writing, in that you learn things about your characters while you're bringing them to life. You know, they take you down unexpected roads. I mean, you could perhaps see the main road, but the novel lives and breathes or dies in the detours, you know, and the detours are really unexpected. And that, I think, is the magical part of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious about some of those detours, some of the biggest surprises that came out of this novel for you. If the novel sounds fairly well intentioned before you started it, and so what were some of the bigger surprises that revealed themselves to you?
Well, probably the single biggest surprise was that Iqbal, who is the husband of one of the four women, and Iqbal is an interesting character because he starts out as a young radical, much like the other four women, but at the time the novel opens and we finally get to meet him, he is very much a conservative Muslim. So one of the main surprises was that Iqbal demanded a voice in this novel. Mm. And the first draft that I had written basically was only from the point of view of the four women and one of the husbands. But Iqbal was a silent, you know, although he's a very influential character in this novel, he really sort of controls a lot of the action of the novel. We didn't hear from him directly.
Mm.
And after I got done with that first draft, I realized that it was, you know, he absolutely, urgently needed to be heard from. And we needed to get inside his mind so that we could have, even while we might disagree with some of his actions, there would be a kind of compassionate understanding of where he's coming from. And I think that was probably, for me, in terms of character development, one of the biggest surprises.
Isn't that what makes good characters, though?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Were there any challenges from writing from, I don't know if it's more difficult to write from gender perspectives, from male perspectives, or if it's more difficult to write from other perspectives, meaning, you know, religion, culture,
yeah,
ethnicity. Where are the biggest challenges for you in trying to tap into character?
You know, I guess I'm lucky in that I never feel challenged in terms of my understanding of a character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I felt like I could occupy, you know, Iqbal's skin and understand him as deluded as some of his thought patterns were. I could understand him as clearly as I could understand the other characters who might be closer to me in terms of gender and class and all those things. So that's not so much the challenge. The challenge for me always is voice.
Mm.
You know, Iqbal should sound like Iqbal and not anybody else. And that's true for all the characters in the novel. And it's sort of hearing that melody, if you will, hearing that voice and what it sounds like, and then somehow being able to translate that on paper, that for me is always the biggest challenge, and frankly, the most exciting challenge.
Yeah.
You know?
So yeah.
It's not anything I dread. It's something I have a lot of fun with.
Do you stay with a particular character for certain months or, you know, certain periods of time, or do you switch between them?
No, I pretty much write most of my novels in chronological order.
Okay.
So, you know, and in this particular novel, you know, there's six points of view.
Right.
And almost each chapter takes you inside the head of a different character. So I just switch back and forth, I guess. And for whatever reason, that doesn't seem to be that oppressive or that difficult to do.
Yeah, and I assume that writing from one character's perspective would inform the next one, and sort of, you know, you can learn things about one through the actions of another.
Well, precisely. And then, let's face it, I mean, a novel is a constructed thing, so that the dictates of plot also force you to switch points of view fairly often.
Right, Darn it. My guest this morning is Trudy Umregard. The book is The World We Found. So I'm curious a little bit about, I love talking to expat writers and their experience of their country of origin and their experience of the U.S. I think that gives you such a unique perspective on both the country you came from, looking back at it from a distance, and from the country that you've come from, looking at it from the perspective of, you know, growing up somewhere else.
Right.
I don't know if through the course of any one of the four or five, the five novels that you've written now, maybe the memoir, how has your understanding of India changed over through your writing life or through your writing about it?
That's a great question. You know, clearly my understanding of certain people that I knew in India, and I'm thinking more of the memoir as I say this than the works of fiction, but you know, the act of writing is so liberating in the sense that it really does teach you things that you didn't even know existed, you know, lessons that you didn't know you needed to learn. So in that sense, just the act of writing is deeply spiritual or deeply educational at the very least. But in terms of my understanding of the culture itself, I don't know that it's changed that much. I guess what I find as the bigger challenge perhaps is, you know, especially to Western audiences these days, because all the news that's coming out of India, it seems like, you know, yay globalization and, you know, the masses of people suddenly becoming middle-class people and those kinds of things. And I always find that my obligation is to say, look, no doubt about it, it's a country that's in tremendous flux. You know, there are changes happening all over the place, and some of these changes are very in your face. I mean, they're very visual and physical changes. There are skyscrapers, you know, going up where there used to be a slum the day before. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, I happen to think that in terms of this belief that somehow this prosperity is trickling down to the masses, I don't see that kind of a change. Mm. So for me, what's more fascinating is how little India is changing as opposed to how much it is. And again, without taking anything away from the changes that are undoubtedly happening and the fact that individual lives have been transformed and probably for the better, because mm-hmm. of globalization, but you know, structurally speaking, I don't see that much change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it easier for you? I don't know how often you go back to visit India, but I'm wondering if it's easier for you to write about it at a distance, or if some of the details, I imagine the sensory details are really embedded in you, but some of the cultural details have to be, you know, as it's changing so rapidly, you know.
Absolutely.
Just
yeah
movie
I
stars
seem
and
to
things.
Average a trip every two and a half years or so, and that feels just right, because it's enough time to be able to weigh between what feels like a more fundamental lasting shift versus, you know, a pop trend, you know, something that may be in fashion today but won't be in 6 months' time. So those kinds of assessments, I think, as a writer, you have to make constantly. You know, the idiom changes, the language changes, new phrases become popular, and you try, if it makes sense, you try to utilize those in your novels. But in terms of the larger question, I do believe that, you know, the sort of distance, the physical distance of being in America also produces a kind of critical distance, both in my examination of the culture or the society itself, but frankly also in my own examination of myself and mm-hmm. how I've evolved and changed over the years as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was absolutely crucial for me. In other words, I'm not even convinced that I would have liked very much to have been a novelist, even if I had continued living in India. But I'm not at all convinced that I would have. And that's not simply because of the fact that the opportunities are greater in America than they probably would have been in India, but also a kind of psychological development that may not have occurred, you know, that essential, crucial distance that one needs to be able to write about things from the past or even things from the present. I just don't know if my life in India would have provided me with that.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that leads me to a question that I had, which was if you had stayed in India. I know that you were writing since you were a small child and you were writing poetry and whatnot. And if that environment was supportive of writers or if indeed it is easier to be a writer here in the U.S.?
Gosh, I grew up in how would I term it? It was clearly an upper middle class family, but it was also a very aspirational family, if that's the right term.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a family of business people, so there was nothing in my immediate life that would have cultivated my notions of my dreams of being a writer or would have encouraged those. In fact, even leaving India to become a journalist in America was pushing the envelope as far as I possibly could, you know, because at least that came with a steady paycheck, and that was a compelling enough argument. You know, it was not anywhere near the kind of hefty paycheck that my parents would have wished for me, but at least it was a job. But frankly, if I had gone around when I was 12 years old telling people I wanted to grow up to become a poet or a writer, either they would have sent me to the doctor in a hurry, or they would have just laughed, you know. So there was nothing in my immediate environment that made that remotely plausible. I didn't know. In the larger family circle, I didn't know anybody who made their living doing such crazy things as writing books. So it would have been an uphill battle, I'm sure.
In fairness, there are probably a lot of American families that could say that too. American
absolutely.
Writers, right? Yeah,
absolutely. So it's not so much a criticism of India, so much as just the kind of middle class environment that I was raised in.
Yeah, right. Tell me a little bit about. Getting back to sort of crafty nuts and bolts questions, I'm a little bit curious about your structuring process and your revision process. So you said that you have a fairly good idea when the novel starts out of where it's going, and then you write it in a linear fashion. Tell me a little bit about the revision process. Once do you kind of throw it all out on paper and you have kind of 500 pages and then it's a process of massaging? Are you a person that needs to sort of get things right before you move on to the next chapter? Tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah. The way it works for me is let's say I finish a chapter in, 2 days or whatever, however long the chapter takes. The next morning, before I go back to writing a fresh section, I'll generally spend, 15, 20 minutes quickly reading over what I've written the day before and making small changes along the way, word choices, sentence structure, but really at the sentence level. Once in a while I'll be struck with something and say, man, this section really needs to be expanded, and then off I'll go in some, one of those magical detours that I was just talking about.
Mm.
But very often I try and refrain for whatever reason from doing that. I like to do fresh work every day. So because of this process, by the time I get done with, quote-unquote, the first draft, in some sense it's actually the second draft, because I have been sort of rereading what I've written the previous day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that's done, in the last couple of books, what I've been doing is turning to a friend of mine who is a local writer, Sarah Willis, in Cleveland also, and I'll just give her the manuscript to read for a day or two. And she usually, I said a day or two, I meant a week or two. Sorry. she's fast, but she's not that fast. And at the end of it, I basically just ask her for, the larger questions. Have I addressed the larger questions? In other words, she doesn't do any kind of line editing for me, but she basically tells me, this needs to be developed, this theme needs to be developed a little bit more, this character needs to speak more, whatever. Then I sit with those suggestions for a few days, see what really agrees with me, what makes sense, what I don't agree with. And on the basis of that, I tackle another draft. So it goes.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Thridi Umrigard. The book is The World We Found. Does one novel... I guess there's a two-part question. One is, does one novel sort of feed another? As you're working on one, do you think that the novels are sort of in conversation with each other and that, one gives rise to another? Or do you feel like they're just really separate individual works on their own?
I think more of the latter. It's just the way, I guess, my brain is wired. It's really important for me to feel a sense of closure. And in fact, I think it's a little dangerous to have sort of the mood or the emotions or the style, heaven forbid, of one novel sort of bleed into the next. I think you almost have to think of them as disparate objects. And so I really try to get done with one book. I mean, I've heard of writers who juggle writing three manuscripts at one time, and to me, that's like a recipe for a trip to the loony bin, you know? I mean, there's just no way I could handle something like that. It's hard enough just keeping your focus on, you know, living in a fictional world while trying to remember to brush your teeth and tie your shoelaces and function in the real world. I mean, it's hard enough to do that with one book. I can't imagine doing it with more than one at a time.
But
you know, I always think of like pop songs, you know, how by certain singers, like all the tunes fundamentally sound the same.
Yeah.
And I really have no respect for singers like that. And I always think of that as a kind of cautionary tale that you don't, I mean, on one hand, yes, writers have individual styles, and that's important to recognize and something to cherish. But on the other hand, the style or the voice of a book should be dictated by the book itself. It shouldn't be superimposed by the narrative voice of the writer.
Right. I agree with you. I would love to have you read to us for just a minute, if you could.
Sure.
Introduce our listeners to this. This is The World We Found. It went on sale yesterday, published by HarperCollins. And read to us.
Okay. So this is a section from somewhere in the middle of the book where one of the four women, Nishta, who is now married to Iqbal, who has forced her to take on a Muslim name, so her Muslim name is Zoha, and she is contemplating leaving him, and she still wants to give him one last chance, and in the middle of the night she wakes him up and they have this conversation. Nishta trembled from the bitterness she heard in Iqbal's voice. "But she's our friend," she cried. "You yourself used to say that RMIT was the sweetest person in college. Remember how she used to?" "This world is full of kind people, Zoha," Iqbal said. "But kind people didn't stop me from losing my job at the bank. Kind people didn't stop the genocide in Gujarat. And they won't keep Umar alive. And I must say, I'm surprised at your definition of friend. Someone who didn't care to contact you for over 25 years, who suddenly decides she must see you again before she passes away, that's a friend?" "That's unfair." Nishta dug her fingernails into her hand to focus her anger. "We are the ones who pulled away from them. You began to act so peculiarly around our friends that it was easier for me to stay away rather than to make excuses for you all the time." Iqbal was silent for so long that she wondered if she'd gone too far, but when he spoke, his voice was distant and mild. "You've let one visit from the past turn your head, Zoha. You're still a child, beguiled by candy at the fair. These rich people, they're like cotton candy, sweet, but spun of air." He yawned and turned onto his side. "Your place is here, Zoha, with your husband and your in-laws. Now go to bed and let me sleep for a few hours in peace. Please." He rolled onto his side, his back to her, and she listened in astonishment as Iqbal fell into his regular breathing in just a few minutes. "His house is on fire. His wife is burning next to him, and he sleeps," she thought in wonder. Because his pitiless words had singed her, had made the last of her illusions go up in smoke. She wondered now why she had felt so tenderly towards him just a few moments ago. What had made her give him a second chance? "This emotional seesawing is the reason why you've spent all these years in hell," she scolded herself. "You're like a dog that whimpers when kicked and then wags his tail each time his master pets him absentmindedly." She had never understood the custom of a Muslim man being able to divorce his wife by merely repeating the word talaq three times. "Talaq, talaq, talaq. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you." It had always appeared too simple, too easy, like a child's recitation of a magical incantation. Now she understood something, that the words were merely an outward expression, a delayed airing of an emotional process that had already taken place. That indifference was the true divorce. After that, it was just words. After that, it was merely action. Mm.
That was Thrudy Umregard reading from The World We Found. That's beautiful. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering if you have any words of advice for writers.
I guess my fundamental word of advice for writers is write. Seriously, I mean, don't talk about writing. Don't go up to friends and say, you know, I have this great novel in me, but if I only had the time and if the kids weren't wailing and if my boss was not breathing down my neck. The fact is, if you want to do it badly enough, you should.
Yep. I like it. And
sorry, it's called tough love, I guess.
You know, it's good. It's good. That's what writing takes is tough love. I think that's exactly right. The book is The World We Found. It went on sale yesterday. And Thrudy, it's always a huge pleasure to read your work. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed this. Bye-bye.
Me too. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Photographic journalist Vicki Goldberg will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby. Don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Why do you linger here when there is no hope?
There is still hope.
Tempted to think there's no hope for overcoming some of the challenges of modern life? Ask an elf.
Or a hobbit.
Tune in Tuesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. with Milo Lomsdown at your service and...
Tawny Tenuvial, the resident KUCI Middle Earth Elf.
For What Would Arwen Do? On KUCI Irvine, 88.9 FM, and streaming live on KUCI.org.
Oh. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Hey, this is Dr. Michael Drake, Chancellor of the University of California, Irvine, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and over the web at kuci.org. I love Anita Radio.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. And this show will join the other shows up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We have a speaker series event coming up on Tuesday, January 17th, at the Scape Gallery. Our first of 2012, T. Jefferson Parker will be joining us again. I'm not entirely sure if tickets are available. I think there are a couple of seats left. This event sold out fast. We have a huge fan base for Jeff Parker. And so if you're interested, I encourage you to visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, and there will be information up there for you on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Vicki Goldberg. Vicki is the leading voice in the field of photography criticism. Her book, Photography in Print, Writings from 1816 to the Present, was cited by the Wall Street Journal in 2006 as one of the five best books of all time on photography. Vicki was a photography columnist for the New York Times for 13 years, and she has written numerous articles for Vanity Fair, American Photographer, and other magazines. The latest book is The White House, The President's Home, in Photographs and History. It's published by Little Brown, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Vicki, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. So tell me, did the White House find you, or did you find the White House?
The White House Historical Association, which is a nonprofit, non-governmental association closely tied to the White House, found me. They asked my advice, saying they'd published a lot of books, but they didn't know whether they have a book just about their photographs. And I said, show me some. And, well, I looked at them, and I said to myself, whoopee. There were lots of photographs there I'd never seen. They hadn't been published for 100 years or more, many of them. And some of them were very surprising. Some of them were quite wonderful. And we found more in presidential libraries in various places.
Amazing.
So it was just a load of photographs from the 1840s to the 2010 that were new and surprising and informative, and that I couldn't resist.
Now, had you done any work in and around the White House, and specifically, I don't know, White House presidents before, or was this a new subject area for you?
Well, it was really a new subject area for me. I've done a lot of work in history associated with photography. I did a book called The Power of Photography, How Photographs Changed Our Lives, and the picture of Lincoln in 1860 that's in the new book was also in that book, because that picture changed both the history of photography and the history of celebrity, and also the history of elections. First photograph that ever influenced an election. And that earlier book was about photographs that influenced, that I felt I could document specific influences from specific photographs. So I'd been in historical areas, many of them associated with government, before.
Amazing. Now, when they came to you, did they have an idea of how they wanted the book to go? Did they have sort of the scope laid out for what they wanted, or did they just sort of throw a million photographs into your lap and say, you know, shape this and make it into something great?
When they came to me, they weren't even sure they had a book of photographs. That's what they wanted my advice for. And I had complete choice of the photographs, and I had the complete choice of how to lay it out. I mean, I suggested it to them. If they had disagreed, which they really didn't, we would have changed some. But I had to wrestle these photographs. The first things I looked at were 5,000 to 6,000 photographs, and there have been more since then. And I had to whittle them down, needless to say, to some sort of a book size and into some sort of thematic presentation. I didn't want to do it just chronologically. I thought, because it's not a total history, not every single president, for instance, is in there. But when I looked at them, I realized I could do it as the House and the East Room, which is the most important room, the presidents themselves, the presidents' families, their wives, their children. I would sneak in to some of these things, their guests and their staff. And then I did a chapter on the pets, and one on the relationship of the administration to the media, a very important topic, and to of the involvement of administrations with technology, which is something that has almost never been dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the intimacy of this book was really striking to me. There was some of the images, you know, after going through it a couple of times, the images that keep sticking out. George Bush the First and Barbara Bush are in. There's a photograph of them in bed with their grandchildren, and there's another one of Betty Ford. I think it's Betty Ford dancing on a dining room table. I don't know. It felt like such intimate access to. I don't know. It felt like such intimate access to people's lives that to a life that's usually, you know, lofty and inaccessible. And these were wonderful. These were wonderful.
Well, I think that's been happening, been steadily increasing since about the third quarter of the 19th century, when journalism expanded. There were more newspapers, there were more magazines, and there was more gossip. And there was more social life reporting. There were more female reporters. And so people began to be interested in every aspect of the White House. Now, they were not permitted such intimate views, but that's when you started getting more pictures of children, more pictures of wives. By 1900, you have a picture of domestic servants and of the kitchen. Every aspect of the White House became of interest. But in our time, in the last, let's say, 40, 50, maybe even 60 years, as there has been more interest in more centrality of the president and the government, and as there has been more intimacy more recently than 60 years ago with talk radio and with reality shows and with talk television where people confess to having been abused as children, it began to be felt quietly that the president and his family were pretty fair game. So even the last photograph of that book is a photograph of Michelle and Barack Obama in an elevator going up to an inaugural party, and they're having a very sweet moment head-to-head, really embracing at a very slight distance. And you see the Secret Service man at the side of the elevator sort of embarrassed by this. They're all looking in different directions, but the photographer is looking directly at them. And that's what's happened with photography and with privacy, I think. And as I said, the president has become, even though he's a president and he's your government leader, he's become somebody that we all feel entitled to know a great deal about.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, I suppose being photographed as much as the presidents and their families are, they become sort of immune to the media around them in a way that makes them very unselfconscious over time. But it is amazing the amount of intimacy that they can carry on, disregarding the number of people around them and specifically the photographer around them. I imagine photographing, you'd have to be very in the shadows, I suppose, and you know, not in their faces to catch some of these moments.
Lyndon Johnson's photographer, Yoichi Okamoto, was given very great access, although Johnson retained the right to nix any particular picture. But Okamoto had been a CIA operative, so I think he was probably very good at blending himself into the wall and not appearing particularly. But more and more, presidents' administrations have felt that they have to make themselves accessible to the public. And Obama, for the first time, has appointed an official videographer. So we're going to have not only thousands of pictures, many of them on the White House Flickr stream, but thousands and thousands and thousands, but we're also going to have every single movement that he ever made outside in public.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, the thing I love about the White House as a subject matter is the number of ways that you can come at it and the myriad ways an audience of readers will enjoy it. You know, I think people will enjoy it for a lot of different reasons. And the task before you seems so daunting to me to try and figure out how to shape the book. So maybe we can talk about structure just a little bit and how you settled on the way to tell this story and which chapters you were going to include and wrapping your mind and your experience around the material that you were given. Can you talk a little bit about structuring the book and deciding where to put your focus?
Well, the book was really photographically driven, but then I'm pretty driven to do research, and I did a great deal. And so I figured I could do thematic chapters and do each one of them chronologically, so that when you get when you start with the president, you start in 1843 with John Quincy Adams, who was ex-president by then, and you end with Barack Obama, who is still with us as president, if only for a while, one is not certain. But I began to see certain affinities in these photographs. I began to realize, for instance, that there were a lot of pictures of pets. Just coincidentally, the last 16 presidents have had dogs, but presidents have had raccoons and possums, and I don't have pictures of it, but Teddy Roosevelt's children had a lot of snakes. Alice Roosevelt had a favorite one she carried in her purse to parties. But I can write that into the text, even if I don't have a photograph, because I did an introduction for each chapter. And my editor cut out one chapter quite correctly, actually, because the book was getting too long. But it was a chapter on advertisements about presidents and about the White House. Most of them were not photographic, particularly the early ones. And in the 19th century, they just played fast and loose with presidents. They, for instance, Frances Cleveland, who was young and attractive, was her portrait was used in advertisements for face creams and for lingerie, and the president was furious. There was nothing he could do about it. It wasn't until the 20th century it became more pictures of the White House. But I really began to see that I had wonderful portraits of presidents, that I had very interesting pictures of the White House, which has been reconstructed several times. Twice it was thought that the White House had to be torn down because it was in such bad shape. And that was not done in the 1870s, and it was not done under Truman because he said, no, you can't tear this house down. It means too much to the American people, and they would be too upset if they didn't see it there. So what they did was to gut it to the third floor and leave the outside wall standing. And there's an incredible book, picture that really surprised me, of a bulldozer inside the White House, nothing I ever expected to see. But I began to see that there were interesting pictures of the White House, particularly of its reconstructions that had never been seen, that there were presidents' portraits, that there were a lot of pictures of the presidents with their wives, or of the wives all by themselves, or the wives with their children, or the children. Two of Teddy Roosevelt's boys posing with the White House security police as if they were on roll call. And a famous picture of John Kennedy underneath JFK's desk. And I included only a couple of iconic pictures like that, but that one I included because we had found a picture of Caroline Kennedy visiting Obama in his office. When she came in, she said, oh, you are using the same desk my father used. It was the desk Queen Victoria gave to America. And when Obama heard that, he remembered that picture of John underneath the desk. John had been at a trapdoor in one of the side portions, and he immediately got down on the floor looking for that trapdoor, which was locked. But so we have a picture of Obama on the floor looking for the trapdoor that John came out of, and the picture is right next to John. When you begin to see affinities like that, you figure that you can put them together. Or, for instance, there's a picture of the first White House fleet of automobiles. That was under William Howard Taft in 1912. And there's also an incredible picture of a small biplane, and I think the same year, flying right over the facade of the White House. I mean, it looks like it narrowly missed it, which I think it did. And it landed on the White House lawn, and it came to within 30 feet of President Taft, who subsequently gave the pilot a medal, probably for stopping in time. But those pictures were evidence of how Taft had advanced the rather new technology of automobiles. When the president adopted automobiles. Teddy Roosevelt wouldn't ride in one. He thought they were too elitist. And Taft realized they would be good for rich and middle class alike, and that they would be an important American industry. And similarly, the military had refused Frank Lloyd Wright's offers of showing them how to use their airplanes. It was Taft who made that an important part of the military and ultimately of the commercial life. So when you begin to see affinities like that, you realize you've got a theme. You've got a theme of technology and automobiles and airplanes. You've got a theme of family when you get the children. There's a lot in there about people taking photographs of the president. In fact, my favorite one of those actually is Harry Truman taking pictures of the White House News Photographers Association on the White House lawn saying, "I take a picture of the Wine More Club."
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the White House press photographers made him an honorary member of the Wine More Club. But there's a little chapter in there called Cameras in the White House. I've got Grace Coolidge taking a photograph and Florence Harding taking a photograph. And my favorite in that is a very recent picture of a man on a Segway taking pictures of three people on Segways standing in front of a White House facade to prove that they've been there. So these things began for me to fall into chapters that would make sense together. And that, as I said, if I did those chronologically, if I started at the earliest and went to the latest, you would get, 8 or 9 independent histories of different aspects of the White House, of the family life, of the even the servants. They're not a separate chapter, but there are several pictures of servants there, of the relations with the media, of what kind of pets were favorites in the White House. Very charming picture of Clinton's cat Socks at a lectern, as if you were about to give a public speech. And some of those pets are quite amusing, but there were different things that seemed to me to ask for their own histories.
Right. Yeah, I love it. My guest this morning is Vicki Goldberg. The book is The White House, The President's Home and Photographs and History. You've mentioned a couple, but I'm wondering if there were huge surprises that came out of this for you.
Yes, there were quite a lot of them. Like the bulldozer was really a terrific surprise. And there's a picture of a White House domestic servant named Jerry Smith, which is just a picture of a man in 1901 with a feather duster. But when I looked him up, I discovered not only had he served 5 different administrations and was very popular, except with people who knew him terribly well, but he swept all the cigar butts and everything like that under the radiator, and he emptied spittoons out the window once on a soldier's head. And he was a spiritualist. He has said he'd seen Lincoln going all the up and down the stairs, and he'd seen Grant several times, and that Mr. McKinley, who'd recently been assassinated, tried to speak to him. So there were surprises in the backstories of some of these photographs, as well as the surprises of the photographs themselves. Was it Grace Coolidge who has the raccoon? I mean, whoever dreamed of keeping a raccoon as a pet in the White House? That hadn't occurred to me. There was one of the later press agents doing his work in the bathroom because the press room had become too crowded. This picture of the plane coming over the White House just stunned me. And there's a wonderful picture of a dirigible making its first visit to the White House. It's way up in the sky, and the White House is way down. And there's a picture of a man up on an enormous crane. Somebody had to teach him how to take a photograph from that angle, and he is photographing the White House from as aerial as he can get without going up in a helicopter. And there are pictures of tree roots in a big ditch. When the reconstructions began, they tried very hard to preserve as much as they could. So they kept the roots of these trees so they could keep the trees, but they had to get underneath to put in something to shore up the White House. And there's a picture of the West Wing on fire in 1929. I didn't know that had ever happened. It was quite lucky it didn't burn the White House down, but it did not hit the house itself. I could go on, but I won't.
It's funny because one of the things that occurs to me, usually in writing nonfiction, is I'm always worried about the inconvenient truths, you know, the things that happen that you just have to kind of work around and fit into the storyline, even if they don't fit the storyline. But it strikes me that all of the inconvenient truths of this is what makes up the story, you know, that all of the crazy stuff is the stuff that people want.
Well, yes, it really is a kind of inside look at the administration. It's not very much, although it's there, it's not very much about the foreign policies, for instance. I mean, we do have Teddy Roosevelt in a bulldozer at the Panama Canal, and the background of that is that he did something that, without congressional approval, he really wanted. He stationed the Navy off Panama so it could become independent and he could get a treaty to put the canal through there. One of his cabinet secretaries said something like that he had been accused of seduction and had proved himself guilty of rape. But that if it's important in the picture, there is politics in it. But this is really about the House, the administration, and often what it did, like the issue of Taft having encouraged automobile production and ownership and having encouraged the military to take up the airplane. The French did it long before America did because the previous presidents weren't interested, which is rather astonishing to me. So there certainly is a great deal of real history in there.
Amazing.
But there is also a great deal of background history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's stunning. It's stunning. Has this led you to your next project, or is this feeling self-contained and closed in and of itself, or does it sort of make you want to explore either this or something related to it a little bit further?
Well, there's something I do want to do a little further. I think it may not be a book. It may be a long article, but I can't talk about it because I haven't even really thought it out yet. But there are so many more pictures that are revealing, and there's so many more topics that could be got into it.
Yeah, that's the sense of this is that there's a wide underbelly of other things here to explore. That's wonderful.
Yeah, true.
Unfortunately, we've drawn down on our time. Is there any advice that you give the creative types out there, either photographers, journalists, writers in general? Anything that you can impart in the last minute here?
Well, mainly it's to stick with it. It's such a wonderful field, and a lot of journalism is threatened at the moment. I mean, there's plenty of it on the web, but it doesn't pay. Yeah. But if you really love it, it's really worth continuing with. I've had a great time in all the years I've been in this business. Photographs are a wonderful field. They are full of aesthetic interest, they are full of historical interest, they are full of theoretical interest, they're full of, I can't tell you how much they have to offer. So, and for photographers, I think it's getting tougher too. For photojournalists, it's a very tough field at the moment. But some of them have found a way to make it in this new world, and it's so rewarding, it's very difficult to give it up. Yeah. I don't recommend giving it up.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you're a creative type and this is your calling, I think there's the avenues may be different into it, but hopefully they'll be different, but just as varied as they had been in the past.
I always remember what Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss. Mm. The idea is if you really love something, you'll find some way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Vicki Goldberg, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure for me, too.
That was Vicki Goldberg. The book is The White House, The President's Home in Photographs and History. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day. I saw you and her.
wanna be free.